Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the last segment of the annual wrap-up for 2021. We're going to talk about a topic which is, there's no more important topic before us. It's a topic that is kind of like the backbone of everything we enjoy and our many blessings and the blessings of liberty. And I'm delighted to welcome back John Titus, who has agreed, as a professional attorney, has agreed to now present to us a theme called sovereignty. So, John, welcome to the Salieri Report. Thank you for doing another outstanding annual wrap-up, or another outstanding wrap-up. You've done the Going Direct Reset, you've done CBDC, and now you've taken on the core of everything. This is the real skeleton of the whole financial and governance system. So tell us about sovereignty.
Well, you know, CBDC and Going Direct, you know, I'm familiar with those. I needed to do a lot of research. Sovereignty, I've been working on for a very long time. So it's right in my wheelhouse. I sort of got into this as soon as the reason I created a YouTube channel was that I saw that sovereignty was being threatened, that national sovereignty of the U.S. was headed for a collision course with the criminal bankers who had really taken control of the system. And that's really what kind of drove me. So I've tried to compress all this into one thing, but people don't realize, I think, a lot of times you tend to assume that everything's okay and it's always been that way and it's always going to be right that way. And there's a lot of stuff you take for granted. And when you boil it down and you look into, you know, what is really propping up our system, it really comes down to the rule of law and the legal institutions we have. And that right just affects everything. Without the rule of law and without law enforcement, everything else topples. And right, I think that that's going to come across in this presentation.
Well, one of the things I used to always say is, you know, the stock, if the stock market is trading at a multiple of 10 or 20, that multiple is only there if there's the rule of law. If the rule of law goes away, it's trading at one or less, right? There's no leverage.
Valuations can't be done without law.
Right.
Right. And they can't be enforced without the rule of law. You know, we'll see that as we get into it.
Well, I can create a market price for food. In other words, people are going to want food whether there's law or not, and they'll bargain and create prices for it. But if you take anything that's based on a contract, you know, a bond or a stock, it's yep meaningless. It's worthless without the rule of law. So right, the entire financial system basically grinds to a halt back to, you know, what kind of prices people can create in their own intimate lives, including barter. So, you know, you're back to rocks and sticks and caves without the rule of law.
Right. And even barter, you sort of need the enforcement right of contractual relations. You know, it comes right down to how are you going to enforce the laws and how are you going to resolve disputes
right
in a way that's fair?
Right.
You know, there's a lot that goes into this. There's a lot in sovereignty. It's really the whole ball of wax. But our experience in the U.S., I think, as you'll see here, really comes down to there's some elements of sovereignty that have been bargained away or handed away, and it's costing us big time.
So you describe three kinds of sovereignty. Why don't you dive in and walk us through them?
Yeah, well, let me say up front that the what really drives this discussion and sovereignty is that there really are two key points to look at in American history. One is the American Revolution. That was obviously a very defining moment for sovereignty. It's very helpful to look at it in understanding sovereignty. And the other is the 2008 bailout. You know, the more I look at that event, the more I'm like, wow, that really did have a major impact on sovereignty. So I want to get into this with just a clip from a few years ago. Let's see if you can guess where the clip is from. And just play this clip to sort of set the table for what was going on, you know, why I'm saying that the 2008 bailout was such a pivotal event, because I'm not the only person who saw that. There were other right people who saw the same thing at the same time. So let me run this clip to sort of kick off the whole discussion. Okay, you see that?
Yep.
Okay, let's hit it.
Think of it as the financialization of the economy and the speculative activity in real estate substituting other areas of growth.
He replaced manufacturing with gambling, essentially. And that's a big change. And it set off a vicious cycle. It's reversing American history.
We're going back to a monarchy slash corporate statism is really what it is. It's not left and right anymore. It's the individual versus the corporate state.
It's the individual versus the corporate state. Man, is that not the truth? Any idea where that clip came from?
No.
Yeah, that clip is from my film, Bailout, which came out in 2008. That was the
first guy
was Chris Whalen. He's an investor. He's a bank analyst at it's Research Analytics. And then it's that guy, obviously, is Noam Chomsky. And they're both saying, hey, you know, these bailouts, what's gone on and what's led up to these bailouts is the financialization of the economy. And it's reversed American history. And we're going to see that exact same thing. In fact, in a lot of ways, the 2008 bailout, when you look at it, it has really, in a lot of ways, it has reversed the American Revolution in a way that is quite astonishing.
Well, I would say it's the financial coup and the bailouts combined, because to me, the bailouts consolidated and made the, you know, basically you got away with that first $4 to $8 trillion of missing money. You locked it in and then you kept going.
Right. And I will freely concede that when the coup d'etat in this country occurred is open to question. But what I'm going to show you here is that it was likely, I think, right before the bailouts, but certainly it preceded the 2008 TARP bailout. And I'll just leave it at that for now and get into it. Earlier, though, you had asked me about the two types of sovereignty, and I'll just get into it and just tell you right now. It's extrinsic and intrinsic sovereignty, extrinsic being other countries, intrinsic being the U.S. When I first saw that, I was inclined to think, you know, extrinsic sovereignty is to prevent your country from being murdered by another country. Intrinsic sovereignty is to prevent the country from committing suicide. But the more I look at it, I'm like, well, it's really to prevent the murder from outside and the murder from inside, which is why the oath, when people take an oath to uphold the Constitution, it's to defend the country against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So the founders knew full well that we had domestic enemies. And so that's why I say it's really sovereignty is a defense mechanism. But there are two different forms, intrinsic and extrinsic. So I'll get into that right now. Let me get back to this presentation here. So here we have sovereignty, extrinsic, and intrinsic. So let's just cover those basically. Extrinsic sovereignty, that derives from the Treaty of Westphalia back in the 1600s. The Treaty of Westphalia is a lot like the Magna Carta. You know, nobody really knows what it said, but they know that the rule of law came out of Magna Carta. And likewise, out of Westphalia, we got a couple of principles that really are non-controversial now. They're so well-worn and well-understood.
So it's interesting. I started to write, when they started to do the economic sanctions, I started to write about the use of mercenaries and the compromising of the Treaty of Westphalia. So you'd be surprised how many of the longtime subscribers have heard about the Treaty of Westphalia.
Yeah.
I think it's very important.
It's hugely important. And the two concepts we'll see here, like I said, they're so important that they're almost non-controversial. But they are, number one, each country is absolutely sovereign within her territorial boundaries. And number two, other countries should not interfere with a country's internal affairs unless the other country is the U.S. and the country's internal affairs is Ukraine. That's okay. But that's the two basic notions of sovereignty. You know.
So this was why remember the big fight over renditions? This is why the renditions were such a shocking and important issue.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And we'll see the renditions appear in the Declaration of Independence, as do any number of crimes by King George III. And we'll touch on those briefly.
Right.
But to get back to sovereignty, so that's extrinsic sovereignty. It's sovereignty within your borders. And then other countries not being able to interfere from outside. That's extrinsic sovereignty. That's not particularly controversial. The much more interesting topic here is intrinsic sovereignty. So let's go to that. Intrinsic sovereignty boils down to who rules, right? Who is going to be the boss? And there are basically two poles in who rules. There are two different extremes. Then one is sort of the Hobbesian, it's a single person with supreme authority over everybody else, that person being essentially the law, whatever that person says goes. That would be a tyrant or a dictator. And then the other pole is, you know, you have authority, but it's limited and it's distributed among multiple people in government. And that was an important notion that was really developed by John Locke and really adopted by the colonists. There is, however, what I call the British contradiction, because while Great Britain in the 18th century would have said, yes, we are a nation under the rule of law, number one, and really a nation of limited internal sovereignty, number two, there was a contradiction that I want to bring up here because it's very important. It comes from William Blackstone, who in 1765 wrote Commentaries on the Laws of England. That was an English legal treatise. It was the first legal treatise ever written where he attempts to summarize the law, the sum of all case law at the time. And he says, it's in four volumes, in the second volume, I think it's chapter 17, he says that the king can do no wrong is a necessary and fundamental principle of the English Constitution. And that's problematic because if the king can do no wrong, then that means he can't break the law, which is obviously is somewhat problematic. Now, Blackstone did not meet, by the way, I just got another message. My internet connection's unstable. But Blackstone did not mean that the king is infallible. Blackstone did not mean that the king is perfect. What he means is that as a legal matter, the king, you could start, your legal starting point should be the king didn't do it, basically. It right. might be inadvertence, it might be omission, it might be misinformation, it might have been somebody else, but it wasn't the king. So get that through your head.
The king is never liable.
The king is never liable.
Right.
Obviously, that did not sit well with the American colonies. And their response was, oh, yeah, the king can't do any wrong. Well, they actually set forth any number of crimes by King George III in the Declaration of Independence. I want to touch on one. Because it's so heinous, I was almost shocked me when I went back and reread the Declaration and saw this. The king has constrained our fellow citizens, taken captive on the high seas, to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hand. So either you're going to kill this guy or you're going to kill yourself. That was one of the things he did. So it really gets to the point that the king could do wrong. And so the colonists were very big on the rule of law. And this thus enters the real rule of law coming in from the colonies. And it's basically framed it's John Adams who really sort of drafted it. The tightest and most succinct summation of it was in the Massachusetts Constitution, we are a nation of laws, not of men, really. And that really simplifies the issue because he's saying there, when it comes to governance, you have two choices. You can either be ruled by men like King George III, or you can have a nation of laws. The law would be the supreme authority, and everybody, including someone like King George III, including our leaders, is going to answer to the rule of law. The law is supreme even over the government. The other requirements, there's a few things that come sort of bound up and packaged with the rule of law. It has to be unambiguous. It has to be publicized. It's no good if it's secret. We're not operating a star chamber here. That's King George III. It's got to be clear. You can't say, well, bad guys are going to jail. That sort of sneaks back into the rule of man. The law's got to be clear on its face. The law has to be applied equally over both people and time. So everybody's got to be bound under the law, and it's got to apply You have to get the same input has to give you the same output. And that's why I say over time, because that means legal precedent is important. You can't have two different outcomes based on the same inputs. The same fact pattern has got to give you the same result, no matter when, no matter who. Another and very important point in the Declaration is the law must be consented to by the people. A law that the people do not consent to is per se invalid. That was kind of a radical notion, although another one that was developed by John Locke. And then finally, you know, a law not made according to these principles is void. It's no good. And so that really sort of summarizes.
So in part, what they're saying is law is not just something written and formal. It's part of the culture, too.
Yes. That without people and without consenting people, it's a nullity.
Right.
It's constitutionally void on arrival, any law that's not
so
passed.
What I always call the Constitution a covenant. And it's a spiritual and cultural covenant, not just a legal covenant.
Yep. That's exactly right. That's an ancient notion too, that was developed even before Locke, that there was a social contract that actually predates,
right.
Sort of the modern conception of the rule of law. That goes back a long way. But the Declaration and the founders, with all the trouble they got from King George III, they really, really got it right in the Declaration of Independence. And then they thought about these issues a lot, given their experience. And so it really came down to the sovereign power in the U.S. is the law. It's not, we can't have this anymore. We can't have people who are above the law. That's no good. That's a fatal, fatal mistake. Okay. So continuing on, guns are money. What is that all about? Let me just tell you, there are any number of sovereign powers that are spelled out in the Constitution. There's a lot. There's more than you might think. You know, you could. I went through the Constitution and just sort of wrote down a few of them. The sovereign powers that it's like, wow, there's a lot they talk about. Punishing members of Congress. Providing for a common defense, entering into treaties. That's obviously something, you know, that a government can do and a nation can do. A person can't do it. Raising revenue, collecting taxes and duties. You know, borrowing money on U.S. credit is another one that I tend to slip my mind. Regulating commerce is a big one. Resolving disputes, I mentioned. Coining and regulating money is a big one. Punishing counterfeiters, obviously an extension of that. Setting up a post office. Standardizing weights and measures, issuing credit, another big one, providing for bankruptcies and naturalization, declaring and waging wars, raising armies, standing armies, granting reprieves. I mean, there's a lot. And then executing laws. And then the final one that I saw or jotted down there was conducting jury trials. But out of all those powers, that you see in the Constitution, the sovereign powers, there's a few that stand above the others in terms of their importance. And it boils down to basically guns or money.
Right.
Is it force, the monopolization of violence, essentially, or is it the ability to control money, to issue money? And there was a long running before the Constitution, before the Declaration of Independence, or at the time of the American Revolution, there was a long-running debate over which was the more important, which of those two is more important. And it's loosely speaking, it was a debate. And on one side of the debate, you had Machiavelli, who said, men steal money and bread are the sinews of war. But of these four, the first two, men and steel, meaning armies, the first two are more necessary than money and bread. Because men and steel find money and bread, but money and bread do not find men and steel. Meaning the army can take the money, but the money may not be able to buy the army.
Right.
So that was Machiavelli in 1520. 300 years later, though, you had Thomas Jefferson coming in and saying, banking establishments are more dangerous than standing armies. And he says that in a letter to John Taylor, a little bit, you know, some three decades really after the Constitution was implemented. And so it's like, well, what has changed? What did Jefferson see that sort of, what's the real disagreement here? And so what if you look at what has happened in between the time of Machiavelli and Jefferson, you know, Machiavelli was 1520. We go all the way to Jefferson in 1816. What happened in between? Well, Bank of England was created in 1694. And then Bank of North America was created in 1781. That's what's in between. You have the central bank of those two countries. And that's a big difference, as we're going to see. But right out of the gate, though, you have to understand something about the Bank of North America. Yes, it was the nation's first central bank. It was a bank of issue, meaning it could issue money. But there's more to it than just that. I didn't know this going in to this. I was like, well, I didn't know that. Bank of North America is a very special institution in the U.S. It's the first bank of issue in America. It's the first private bank in America, which I didn't know. The colonies didn't have banks, okay? So the money issuance in the Bank of England and the Bank of North America, money issuance up until the Bank of North America was not the same in England as it was in America, because the Bank of England was basically a private bank. And in America, in the colonies, the first private bank doesn't come until 1781 with the Bank of North America. So there's the money issuance was way different as between the colonies and in Great Britain. In the colonies, right, money was issued by the states, and the states were issuing paper money. And so you could see some examples here of the paper money. It was issued as early as 1690 by Massachusetts. And if you look here, you zoom in, I want to zoom into Massachusetts. You can see that these monies, they're issued in shillings. So they're still using nothing. They're not using dollars early on. So then I think you have Pennsylvania here in the middle, a 15 shilling note. And then on the right, you have the 3 shilling note from New Jersey to counterfeit his death. But the states were issuing money themselves. It wasn't private banks issuing the money. Then it was non-interest bearing money. And that's a big difference.
Right.
And the reason they were having trouble with coins is that precious metal coins kept getting, you know, hoovered up. They kept getting exported back to London. And that was why they forced the colonies to use paper money. It was like, well, why the metal coins are going back to money? Why is that? And that has to do with what was going on with the monetary system in Great Britain at the time, where you had private banks issuing both paper money. So they're issuing paper money too, but it's different in Great Britain, because over in Great Britain, it's the private banks issuing IOU money, not states issuing notes.
Right.
Big difference. And because of the paper money, because it's IOUs, they need the precious metal coins in Great Britain to settle the transactions, right? Because if it's, you know, banks aren't going to take on each other's IOUs freely unless they're able to settle with each other. And that was driving demand. That was one of the things driving demand for the coins, which the banks were also issuing, but they were precious metal coins. And that's how banks settled with each other. So you had a two-tiered monetary system in Great Britain where coins were settling the paper transactions. And that was different, way different in the U.S. The U.S. had a single-tier system where there was no need for settlement because the states, in the form of paper, were issuing real money. So you saw, as I said, two kinds of paper money. You had real money, meaning it was permanent money being issued by the government. It wasn't interest-bearing. It was real money that could settle transactions per se. And you actually didn't need money. You didn't need money to settle transactions because it was only real money floating around in the colonies. And in England, Great Britain, you had debt money being issued by banks, plural. I underline that S in banks, plural, because they weren't coming from the crown. It was the banks by that time had usurped the power to issue money in England. That process had started in the late 1700s. It actually started in the early 1600s, but by the late by the late 17th century, the banks had really taken over that power. And that was really what had led the real colonial conflict was, you see, and this is a quote from Alexander Del Mar, what really drove the revolution was selfish London merchants and bankers who influenced the government at this period would not permit the colonies to have their own monetary system, meaning every time the colonies tried to issue their own money, you know, along would come King George at the behest of London merchants and shut the colonial money down. They wanted, instead of using the paper money, London wanted to rent out its basic money to the colonies, and the colonies were not interested in that. And so the first bank of issue in America is the Bank of North America. And the big mistake is, you know, after all of that, after you have the revolution, you have all these things go on where the U.S. finally breaks free, its money system prevails. But the very first thing they do in 1781 is they adopt the very monetary system that we revolted against in 1775, 1776, right? We fight a whole war against an empire and beat them, and then we turn right around and we say, you know what, we're going to give money issuing power to the Bank of North America, and thus began the spiral of America toward all of the ills of the private issuance of money and the control of the monetary system by banks.
And so
let me show you one quote from Alexander Del Mar, because it's so good. He is so disgusted that the colonists did it, that they hand over the money to a bank. He says, never was a great historical event followed by a more feeble sequel, meaning the revolution followed by handing the money over in 1781. He says, in a word, they, the colonists, planted another revolution. And he says that in Money in America. Anyway, that's sort of the sum total of that in the colonies.
So one of the issues that is often not really thought about or written about, which to me is not only important, you know, in the revolution and on, but goes all the way through and now is a major issue, and that is who can create secret money? If you have the states issuing paper money, you don't begin to have the capacity to create and finance secret operations, covert operations. And right. If you look at the history of the United States, you're watching a history of more and more money being available to finance covert side and covert operations. And so, you know, there's a theme in here about who can afford the best intelligence and who can manipulate knowledge and intelligence. And as we move into a digital system, it's going to get more and more powerful and more important. But the, you know, one of the reasons the bankers have always fought to take the central banks and the banks private is so they can finance secret operations.
That's exactly right. And sunshine is one of the most important features of having public issuance of money.
Right.
Is it you have... we the people have control over that, in that, in theory, if the rule of law is followed, the government's got to follow these laws and has all these reporting requirements, which don't apply even nominally to the banks. That's exactly right.
Right. So if you look at the last 50 years, the people who are most admired have been able to get subsidized secretly and to look like they're the winners when they're really not. You know, the trick has been to get the crowd to follow the criminals. How do you do that? You make the criminals look legitimate, you know, and it all is engineered with the secret money. So, you know, it's going to keep coming back to whether or not private banks can control the money system and therefore can finance the secret operations.
Right. Right. And so what I want to talk about next is, you know, so we see the Bank of North America coming into place in 1781, and it's the first private bank of issuance. Now, granted, the Bank of North America didn't last that long, but it set the trend for banks, private banks of issue. I want to spend some time talking about the real problems with debt-based money, because when it's a bank of issue, as opposed to a state or a government issuing the money, they don't issue money; they issue credit, they issue IOUs.
Right.
And that creates big time problems. So I want to walk through some of the problems, because the problems of debt-based money, they have a cumulative, they snowball, and they get bigger and bigger and bigger, and we're going to see that, okay? So I want to talk about some of the defects with debt-based money are inherent, and some of them are historical, and they make sense. Like, yeah, that jives with my own experience. So I want to get into these so you can see sort of how it snowballs up until 2008, because it really rears its head then. It gets ugly. Okay. So defects of debt-based money, just to sort of punch through what those are. It's temporary and it's unsafe, meaning that the debt money gets extinguished when a loan is paid back. Okay. When a bank issues the money, it issues it as a loan. So a $1,000 loan puts $1,000 of new money into the system, but someone pays back $500 of principal, $500 gets destroyed. So it's up and down and up and down and up and down with debt money. But another problem is your bank, if you're holding debt money and it's coming from a bank, your money is sitting in a bank, you have nothing when the bank fails. Now, of course, after 1934, you do, because the FDIC was there. But that's a real problem. If you're banking with somebody and the bank fails, your money's gone. Right?
Right.
That's a real problem, because basically the money boils down to, it's just an entry on a ledger. Again, it's a creature of law. That ledger is good only as long as the bank is good. Right? And if the bank goes, so does the ledger, so does your money. It's bye-bye. So that's the first defect of debt money. It's temporary and it's unsafe. Next defect. Debt money has no power to extinguish debts. What do I mean by that? It's not legal tender. It can be refused by a creditor. You know, because it's an IOU, it can't necessarily pay off another IOU unless the creditor agrees to it.
Right.
You have to have the creditor's consent. With real money, with what's called legal tender, I mean, in the U.S., legal money is cash and coin. It's Federal Reserve notes and coins. With real money, if you make a tender of real money to your lender, the lender has to take that money. And if the lender doesn't take it, the debt's gone anyway, because you made legal tender.
Right.
And the debt money just continues. It just continues, perpetuates debt servitude, because it doesn't, the creditors don't have to agree to it. It gives the creditors all the power. Next problem with debt money. Its fraudulence causes misery. You're going to love this one. It's fraudulent in that you're getting something for nothing. The banks are creating the money out of thin air. And earlier we saw Thomas Jefferson writing a letter to John Taylor. Now we're going to see Taylor writing a letter to Jefferson. He says, you know, debt money employed not for the useful purpose of exchanging, but for the fraudulent one of transferring property. It converts, currency is converted into a thief and a traitor, and begets, like an abuse of many other good things, misery instead of happiness. In other words, these banks can just create money out of thin air and buy your business.
Right.
You know, just make a ledger entry and they can just take over businesses. Gives the banks enormous control. Next up in the list of defects is the ratchet wrench of debt over money. Or debt, or really interest over principal, would be another way of thinking of it. What do I mean by that? What I mean is, you need new debt to create new money, but you don't need new money to create new debt. So if you want new money in the current system, someone needs to take out a loan. But you don't. The reverse isn't true. In other words, I could go out and borrow money from an insurance company or from, you know, my sisters, and there's new debt in the system, but there's no new money in the system. So you have this exponentiation of debt over real money. And the debt can't ever be paid off. And it increases at a rate way faster than the money. And so without a jubilee, it sets up a real problem. Okay? What is that problem? Booms and busts are guaranteed. Guaranteed. Del Mar writes a lot about this. He says, you know, until private issuance of money, there were no booms and busts. That's right. So how this rears its head in American history through the controlled contraction of the money supply, in which bankers basically transfer money to themselves. And so you walk through the history of contractions in the U.S. It really, all of them are inspired by bankers. They all, right. because they can cancel the money and they can cause depressions.
It's also inspired by bankers planning and working together.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Alfred Owen Crozier, who I talk a lot about or refer to a lot in the write-up, he says 1873 panic caused by bankers, 1893 panic caused by bankers, 1907 caused by bankers. And then Mullins, Eustace Mullins says, and 1920, depression caused by bankers. They do these 1929. They do these things for two reasons. One, when money supply contracts, the value of the bonds goes up. Right. And Wall Street is the big holder of bonds. And number two, because they know it's coming, because it's deliberately caused, they can short stocks, they can short companies. And number three, they can pick up assets dirt cheap when the collapse comes.
Right.
So this happens again and again and again and again. And again, it's a ratchet wrench of increasing bank power.
Okay. It's a harvesting, and after each harvesting, there's more central control.
Yes. More centralized control in the hands of the oligarchy.
So you expand, then you contract, and after each contraction, you have more control.
Yes.
Right.
That's exactly right. And along to that very point, the next thing with booms and busts is bankers use the contractions. In every case there's ever been a contraction, to get favorable laws passed every single time.
Right. And here's what's interesting. Each time they do it, that they say, oh, there's fraud, we need this new law. And they pass another law that will never be enforced, just like the last one wasn't. So the problem is always that the last law wasn't enforced, but they never tell you that when they say, oh, we need a new law, because there's a double standard, and the new laws are enforced against the innocent, and the guilty never have to obey the law.
Right. And so one of those laws that doesn't get enforced, we saw this really got going in the 90s, was the antitrust laws.
Right.
And in particular, the laws that would have barred the mergers. Okay. So what happens? You know, back in the Depression, before the Depression, there were something like 30,000 banks in the U.S. In the 20s, there were 30,000 banks, and 9,000 of them failed. You talk about a contraction of the money supply, that's what happens. Today, there's, 4,400 banks.
Right.
The contraction has been massive because of the merger mania. And the real problem, though, isn't that they're from 30,000 to 4,000. The real problem is that banks, the top 4, 5, 6, 10 banks, whatever, they control a massive percentage of the money supply, right?
Right. Well, the financial crisis significantly increased their market share and control. Significantly.
Yes, absolutely. But going into that, the banks never should have had that much power. They never should. The four banks should never have been in control of 40% of the money supply. I mean, the Great Depression witnessed the contraction of the money supplies to the tune of basically 30% over a period of four years.
But I'm going to be a bad guy. I'm just about to write a review of a book that's about the Federal Reserve over the last 20 years. And they keep talking about the Fed as though its only role is money supply. If you look at not only what they were doing with money supply, but what was being done with fraudulent securities and fraudulent banking transactions and organized crime, we're talking about an organized crime syndicate operating throughout the economy that is deeply integrated with the central bank function and the money supply.
Totally. They also control the entirety of the budget of the National Science Foundation.
Right. So.
You think that you think that's power? Then maybe that's a smidgen of power too much for bankers to have, given what we've seen in the last 2 years.
Right,
that's crazy. But anyway, to continue on with the defects. So the defects; these are serious defects. I want to just touch on the real problem is this one we just talked about: laws not enforced versus bankers. And this has been going on, by the way, the history of non enforcement against bankers. Since the South Sea Bubble in 1720, where the directors were fined and they weren't jailed. There's a book called The Lost Science of Money by Stephen Zarlenga. Came out about 2002. It's an 800-page, like the encyclopedia
of
money.
I have it here. I haven't read it yet. So
it's fantastic.
Yeah, I see it on your shelf.
Yeah, he talks to, if you see it on my shelf, means I'm out of focus. That's not good. But he talks about, Zarlenga is the one who points out that the non-enforcement really started with in 1720. Now, if you think about that, it's like, well, wow, that's a stunning thing, because 1694 was the creation of the Bank of England. And 1704 is when the party really got started. That was the passage of the Promissory Notes Act of 1704. And that is what made debt negotiable. That is when the bankers' IOUs really became money. So think about that. You go from 1704, okay, now the notes, the banknotes are money, to 1720, you've already got your first implosion, and law enforcement isn't affected. It's not right. Implemented at all.
But if you look at that period, John, though, the quality of life, the living standards are really rising dramatically for the last 200 years.
Yes. But a lot of that was, you know, widespread literacy. There was a lot going on, obviously. The bankers would tell you, well, that's because the central bank, please. Please.
But the central bankers did allow some kind of blossoming that's now being reversed. Or they're trying to reverse.
They unleashed a lot of wars. It started that. Now all of a sudden, you can print money willy-nilly. You can finance whole armies overnight.
Right.
You know, the wars, again, it's like the non-enforcement of law started, Zarlenga traces it to 1720, and the wars start more or less right away. So as soon as you turn that power over from the state to the private hands, the party's on. It's game on.
Okay, so the way I always say it is, the bond market made it possible for a ruler to do war on credit, and so you didn't have to tell the people you're going to raise their taxes to pay for the war, particularly if you lost. You could just bank it. If you read Sun Tzu versus Clausewitz, you know, Clausewitz writes about war with the bond market. Sun Tzu writes about war where you have to finance it, pay as you go. It's very interesting to think of the financial ramifications. But once you had a bond market and you could finance war, you know, on credit, you were off to the races.
You were off to the races. Exactly. Right. And overlooked in that is that law, you know, domestically isn't being enforced. And the South Sea Bubble was the first of many, many, many episodes where the law wasn't enforced. And that is that's a huge problem. I'm going to turn back to this, finish this, round this point out. So no jailing of bankers going on since the South Sea. And the tie-in here is, you know, what's driving what here? Is that just a historical tendency, the non-enforcement of law? Or, you know, I think part of it is, if you look, part of it is there's an inherent tie-in. Because if you have the power to issue money, you have to have some power or of force to protect the issuance of that money. Do you follow me? There's some inherent power you have to have. But in any case, the laws not being a force versus bankers, that's a fatal defect, because it grows like a cancer.
Yes.
You know, it grew like a cancer through American history up until 2008. And then we really get into it.
It's a cancer that nobody can get together and stop even when they want to, because it's too out of control.
Right.
You know, I doubt I ever told you this. My father had three kids and he tried to persuade us all to become lawyers because he said lawyers had the power to make it possible for a group of people to not have to obey the law.
Yes.
And that was the greatest power there was.
Right.
Right.
Right. So there's no law enforcement. It goes on. There's a lot of historical examples of non-law enforcement. You saw 1720. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. We get to the financial crisis of 2008. There's a big implosion. And now I want to go to and pick up. It's a big jump here we're making to post 2008, early in the Obama administration, and we're going to look at what the problem with non-enforcement of law is against banks, because it gets absolutely huge, and it points to some real problems that no one's talked about. I want to sort of introduce your readers to a notion that I just drew this connection earlier, but I'll get to it. But right now I want to go to the first term of President Obama's administration. And listen carefully to what he has to say here. It's very interesting. This is 60 Minutes.
I can tell you just from 40,000 feet that some of the most damaging behavior on Wall Street, in some cases some of the least ethical behavior on Wall Street, wasn't illegal. That's exactly why we had to change the laws.
Okay. That is obviously
not true.
Total nonsense. And I'm going to show you that as a matter of fact. But remember Blackstone. The
right.
King can do no wrong. He doesn't mean, you know, this is the president talking. He doesn't mean, as it turns out, that Wall Street banks, as a matter of fact, didn't commit any crimes. Some of the worst behavior, by the way, some of the worst behavior of Wall Street, the worst behavior by definition in a constitutional republic, the worst behavior is by definition crime. So when he says, Obama says, some of the worst behavior wasn't criminal, wasn't illegal, that's absolutely false because he's saying there was
right.
no crime. That's what he's saying. There's no crime. But he means that in a prospective way, like, yeah, we're not going to look at the past crimes. You know, we need to focus on the future. So I want to spend a minute saying and laying out how we know that there actually were crimes
right.
Going on leading up to the financial crisis. And there's an amusing example I want to lead off with. And I'll point out here, this is a Federal Reserve symposium held in Atlanta. That's Ben Bernanke in the center and Alan Greenspan on the right.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
And I say this, I'm going to pull my card and say, I say this as the former Assistant Secretary of Housing. Ben Bernanke and Alan Greenspan engaged in massive securities fraud in the mortgage market and massive securities fraud and depository fraud in effecting illegal transactions as the depository, and God knows what they were doing with the Exchange Stabilization Fund. So you are looking at two people who are guilty of massive criminal behavior, massive systemic criminal behavior. All that fraud was absolutely known to them, and they were facilitating it, and it was intentional.
Okay.
Okay.
I want you to keep, that's a great intro to this clip.
Okay.
I want to just, let's just focus on one thing really quick. So they're both engaged in fraud. This guy right here, though, Greenspan, is 85 years old. And I didn't notice this until I did this presentation. That glass is not water. That glass has the color of wine to it to me, but you be the judge. I want you to listen to what Greenspan says, because he talks about crime and he talks about fraud. And I want you to listen, watch Ben Bernanke's reaction, Ben Bernanke's body language, and really everybody's body language, including the cameraman's body language, when Greenspan gets going in what can only be described as a senior moment. So here we go. Let's listen to this. This is so rich.
All capital that I see is the problem. And I'm not saying there are lots, I think there was rampant fraud in a lot of what was going on in these markets. But my general judgment is that there are two fundamental reforms that we need, is to get adequate capital, and two, to get far higher levels of enforcement of fraud statutes. Existing ones, I'm not even talking about new. Things were being done which were certainly illegal and clearly criminal in certain cases, which, I mean, fraud is a fact. Fraud creates very considerable instability in competitive markets. If you cannot trust your counterparties, it won't work. And indeed, we saw that it didn't.
Ben Bernanke wants to crawl out of his. Even the cameraman's like, I want to get out of here. This is not. This, people in the audience are like, what's he saying? What's he saying? Yeah, there was certainly illegal and clearly criminal.
Right.
And notice too, he says, I'm not even talking, not new laws, Obama. Don't need new laws.
Yeah.
I'm talking about existing ones, like, I don't know, fraud. That's been around 300-500 years. You know, I mean, he just goes off and these guys, so you know. Greenspan just lets the cat out of the bag. Had you ever seen that clip before?
I had never seen that clip before.
That's a good one. Yeah. That's a good one. So his conclusion, Greenspan, rampant fraud on Wall Street, rampant fraud in the markets. And when he says adequate capital, by the way, what he means is collateral that isn't infected through with fraud. He's talking about mortgage-backed securities.
Okay, but
and the failure of Lehman Brothers.
I just want to point one thing out. If you look at the rampant fraud that he is referring to, that rampant fraud can happen unless it is affected daily for years with the help of the Department of Justice, the Department of the Treasury, the New York Fed, and the governors of the Federal Reserve Board. It's kind of like me saying, you know, I'm trying to think of an example. You know, fraud is coming out of your house, but you're not opening and shutting the door to let it in and out. Do you know what I mean? If you look at the mechanical steps that have to be taken day in, day out in the economy to affect all of this fraud, you know, they have to be intentionally doing it.
Yeah. In fact, you're going to see that in the next clip. So you have Greenspan, who I would say he's a Wall Street insider, no doubt. That's where he came from. He's saying, you know, Obama, you're wrong. There was crime and then there was fraud. But even intelligent outsiders were hip to the game, meaning people who had sort of looked at the issue and studied it a little bit.
He said there was fraud. But anybody who knows how the system works knows that what that means is, yes, we were doing fraud.
The odds that there was rampant fraud and he wasn't a part of it are zero.
Zero.
Right. So, and that's why Bernanke is so uncomfortable.
Right. Because he's admitting that the Fed's engaging in massive fraudulent transactions, banking transactions and fraudulent securities. And they're running the U.S. securities market without full and fair disclosure and with material omission.
Right.
Right.
So that clip was, I think that was 2011. Anyway, I want to go to the next one. This next one is of Ted Kaufman, who, remember, Kaufman had stepped in. He's a political outsider, but he, more or less, he had stepped into Biden's shoes in the Senate, including his shoes on the Judiciary Committee for 2 years.
Right. Because
Biden and became the vice president. And that he left the Senate, and so Kaufman fills his shoes. And Kaufman wants to know, hey, you know, what caused this crisis? And here's what he concludes. So Kaufman, by training as an engineer, and then I got an MBA, and I think he was chief of staff in Biden's office for a while. Anyway, he gets on the Judiciary Committee, and this is what he concludes about the matter. So this is a clip. He's talking to Lanny Brewer, but it doesn't really matter who he's talking to.
I mean, I am absolutely convinced after the hearings we had of the Permanent Investigation Subcommittee and the studies I've been doing for this bill that there is rampant fraud in these cases. I mean, I don't see how you can explain behavior other than there was a concerted effort to be engaged in fraud. I am not talking about any specific case.
Okay, so, you know, Obama doesn't know what he's talking about. Could you have Greenspan saying there's rampant fraud? Kaufman, there's rampant fraud. There was a lot of fraud, Obama, and a lot of crime. But the real nail here in Obama's theory that Wall Street didn't perpetrate any crime, any fraud, comes from his own attorney general in the next clip. Let's take a look at this. This is Eric Holder. This is Eric Holder in the UBS UBS case. UBS had been on the hook a number of times for crime. And this is Eric Holder talking about the UBS case. This is late 2012.
All right.
Get this clip here. Okay.
Today, the Justice Department is filing a criminal information charging UBS Securities Japan, a subsidiary of the multinational financial institution UBS AG, with felony wire fraud for engaging in a scheme to manipulate the London Interbank Offered Rate, or LIBOR, a key benchmark for financial products and transactions around the world. The company has agreed to plead guilty to this charge, to admit to its criminal conduct, and to pay a $100 million fine.
So that pretty well kills Obama's theory that there was no crime on Wall Street.
Right.
There was a lot of crime, and his own attorney general just said so. But, you know, as you remember from the UBS case, nobody went to jail. He just said the company admitted that they're pleading guilty. to wire fraud, to fraud. So why is nobody going to jail for that in that case? And you have to know, it helps to understand a little bit of the law here, what it means when a bank commits a crime or a corporation commits a crime. Okay. My legal history professor used to say, you know, corporations, they're fictions. They can't commit crime. They don't have eyes. They don't have a mouth. They don't have hands. You know, they're
really
fixed,
they
they're
have a life. If a death penalty, I mean, I think we ought to have death penalties for corporations. And I would point out that they can die.
Right. But right. His point is they can't. They're legal entities. You know, they're not walking around on the street.
Right.
You know, there's no inherent mind in a corporation. And so the legal theory of prosecuting a corporation, any corporation, it's under the doctrine, what's called respondeat superior. And the basic notion is if a corporation has so many employees, so many high-ranking employees committing crimes, that at some point it becomes fair to charge the corporation itself, the legal entity, as a criminal enterprise. Because
right.
That's what you're doing. You're operating as a criminal enterprise. So when you prosecute a bank, when you say that a bank commits a crime or a corporation commits a crime, keep in mind that it is legally impossible for a corporation to commit a crime without a lot of employees and a lot of high-ranking employees in that corporation committing right. crimes on the individual level. And what you saw with UBS was, oh, yeah, the bank pleaded guilty or the bank committed a crime, but nobody goes to jail. Right.
Right.
You can't put the corporation in jail. So now I want to turn to why that's the case. Like, what's going on here? Why, you know, what? Why give UBS a pass? And so I want to show you this article from Forbes. This came out in 2012, so some months before the UBS case. Obama's DOJ and Wall Street too big for jail. I'm going to cut down to the key section that concerns us and highlight that and just read it. Let me zoom in. Cohen & Burling, the firm from which both Attorney General Eric Holder and Associate Attorney General Lanny Brewer, he's also head of the criminal division, Lanny Brewer, hail, that's their firm, Cohen & Burling, has as its current clients Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, Deutsche Bank, ING, Morgan Stanley, and UBS.
UBS, right.
UBS. As well as MF Global, among others. So that is, so in other words, the Attorney General is getting up there and telling you that, yeah, we're not prosecuting our own client, right? That's what
right.
he's saying.
Right.
Yeah, we're not going to prosecute our own client.
Right.
And that's just, I mean, it's just like, well, we'll get to it in a
right.
minute, how Covington and Burling got in there. But that's just astonishing.
Well, but what it means is all crime is a pricing function. In other words, you know, if I make $1 billion and I pay $100 million in fine, then it's a $900 million profit, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's right. just a pricing function.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. And you don't even worry about the fine because you can pay it out of future proceeds for more crimes.
Right. But I will be a bad guy and say, that to function in a state, you have to have a good standing certificate. And so there's not a state in America that couldn't pull the good standing certificate on JP Morgan Chase or UBS or Citibank and not only not allow them to, you know, to do business with the state government or its pension funds or public benefit corporations and other agencies, but they could pull their standing to function in that state.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. For sure.
Right.
Now, for a long time during Obama's first term, as Ted Kaufman was sort of on their tails saying, hey, you know, we need to rein in this crime. I adjust my volume a little bit. The DOJ, through Lanny Brewer mostly, was offering excuse after excuse after excuse about, you know, why they couldn't prosecute crime. And they were getting a lot of, they were, don't get me wrong, they were prosecuting a lot of crime, but they were small timers.
Right.
Okay. All right. They weren't prosecuting any Wall Street crime. And they kept inventing excuse after excuse. It's all lies. Lie, 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 lie. And when one lie failed, they just moved on to another. Finally, though, in the UBS case, and at the same time, there was the HSBC case, they came up with a new one. And people were like, what? What's this? And I want to play this clip from the UBS. It's from the same hearing, or the same press conference, where they're giving UBS a pass despite the commission of crimes. And listen to what Eric Holder says about why they're going to give UBS a pass here. Let me cut to that clip.
Impact. Let's be honest. Yeah, I mean that's a factor, and I'm not talking about just this case, but in others that we have resolved, the impact on the stability of the financial markets around the world is something that we take into consideration. We reach out to experts outside of the Justice Department to talk about what are the consequences of actions that we might take. What would be the impact of those actions if we wanted to make a particular prosecutive decision or determination with regard to a particular institution? So that factors into the kinds of decisions that we make.
Now, that is an incredibly dangerous statement, because what that means is if you're big enough, you're above the law.
Right.
That's what he's saying. Again, that's sort of the legal policy statement, that if you're big enough, you're above the law. When I first heard that, and for years afterwards, I thought they literally, when he said we reached out to experts, I was like, oh, you reached out to your own clients, you know, your client list, like UBS. That's who your experts are. It's a defendant telling you don't prosecute the defendant. But the more time has gone on, the more I've come to realize that itself, that clip there and the whole notion of collateral consequences of prosecuting a crime, that's a cover story itself.
Right.
Okay. And the way I came to realize that was when I started to think about the implications, I think, of the next clip I'm going to show you. Let me see here. Yeah, here we go. And listen to what – this is from Frontline, The Untouchables. Uh-huh. This is Martin Smith, where he wants answers. Like, why are you not going after these banks? I mean, this was a disaster for the Justice Department and a disaster for Lanny Breuer. Lanny Breuer is number two at the DOJ. He's from Covington and Burling, as we saw. He's the head of the criminal division. Listen to this. This is just insane what he says.
We spoke to a couple of sources from within the criminal division, and they reported that when it came to Wall Street, there were no investigations going on. There were no subpoenas, no document reviews, no wiretaps.
Well, I don't know who you spoke with, because we have looked hard at the very types of matters that you're talking about.
These sources said that at the weekly indictment approval meetings, that there was no case ever mentioned that was even close to indicting Wall Street for financial crimes.
Well, Martin, if you look at what we and the U.S. attorney community did, I think you have to take a step back.
Wow. No investigations going on, no subpoenas, no docket reviews, no wiretaps, no investigations at all. If you look elsewhere in that episode, which came out, by the way, in January of 2013, they confirm you didn't have any whistleblowers, you didn't have any witnesses, you didn't lift a finger.
Right.
So in other words, collateral consequences really didn't have anything to do with it. The real thing is you never investigated.
Right.
You were put in there so that there were no investigations.
It was hands off from the beginning.
Hands off from day. We knew from day one.
Right.
Nobody's going to jail.
So part of it is you can't send people to jail for doing what you've asked them to do. So let me see if I can explain this. We talk about Goldman Sachs and Citibank and JP Morgan like they're separate from the New York Fed. They're not separate. Right. They own the New York Fed. The New York Fed works for them. Okay? And the New York Fed is also the depository for the U.S. government. So all the transactions for the U.S. government are implemented by a subsidiary owned by Goldman Sachs, Citibank, and JP Morgan Chase. And those firms are also the primary dealers selling the securities for the government. And given that $21 trillion, or whatever the number is, disappeared through the U.S. government accounts, the government is dependent on issuing more bonds, which have to be issued with no disclosure. Yeah. So all of this has been engineered by these banks, running the U.S. government, you know, and levering it up into essentially a financially bankrupt or economically bankrupt situation. And they've done it by violating the securities laws and the disclosure laws, permitting all those bank transactions to happen, some of which were illegal, but certainly the government is disobeying the financial management laws. It's disobeying the constitutional provisions were, you know, regarding financial management, regarding financial disclosure. So you have over a 20-plus year period, you're operating, whether it's the issuance of the bonds or the effecting of the bank transactions, you're operating a criminal enterprise financially.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah, and everybody's up to his eyeballs in it. And if you stop doing it, everybody in America does, you know, stops getting their government check.
Right. The crime has become a drug, and you take it off and, you know, the patient dies.
Right.
Because of withdrawal.
Right. And everybody's in on it. So you can't bust anybody for doing what the system is dependent on. In other words, if the system is going to continue the next day, everybody's got to continue to break the law. And so you can't bust them for breaking the law, because that's what you're asking them to do day in, day out, day in, day out.
Yeah. But that's the bargain.
Right.
You know, nobody's going to join your criminal enterprise if they know you're going to roll over on them.
Right. Exactly. Right. So how are you going to prosecute anybody? All you can do is, you know, grab back a piece of the winnings for the, you know, for the bonus pool at the Department of Justice, because they want their fair share of the shakedown.
Yeah. So I want to tie this notion of no investigation, no prosecution, arrest back to the issue of sovereignty.
Right.
Because it has direct implications. And the way I want to do that is I want to compare here what happened to Wall Street with what happened to Nixon.
Right.
Because remember, Nixon got himself in legal trouble, and he asserted the banks just, we saw, asserted sovereign immunity, basically, and they were granted it. Nixon tried the same thing and didn't. So I've set up a comparison here. So who's accused of the crime? We have Nixon, President Nixon, on the one hand, and we have Wall Street banks on the other. Was the accused investigated? Nixon most certainly was investigated by the Justice Department. But the banks, Wall Street banks, we just saw were not investigated. No subpoenas, no document reviews, no wiretaps. There were subpoenas of Nixon. Who asserted criminal immunity? In Nixon's case, Nixon asserted it, you know, through defense counsel. But he asserted immunity himself. With Wall Street, Wall Street banks did not assert immunity. It was the Justice Department asserting immunity on behalf of the Wall Street banks, which ought to be a clue to you that really at that point, the DOJ is representing Wall Street. It's not representing the American people. Was the assertion of immunity successful with Nixon? No. He tried to assert immunity, and the court said, no, absolutely not. Turn over the tapes. Wall Street banks, yeah, they successfully asserted immunity. We just saw that. Is there a written record of the decision-making process? In Nixon's case, yeah, it's called U.S. versus Nixon. It's a Supreme Court case. Now, he wasn't actually the defendant. He was a third party being subpoenaed, but yeah. There's a record of that decision. You can see the court's reason where Nixon tried to assert executive privilege and the court rejected it. But in Wall Street's case, as far as a record of the decision making, no, there's no record at all. And finally, did the defendant get presidential pardon? Nixon did. He got pardoned by Ford. Wall Street, not applicable. Wall Street don't need no pardon, right?
Right.
No. Wall Street got off the hook there. And so,
well, remember, the Secret Service are a group of guys who carry guns around the president. And what we know from the Kennedy assassination is those guns turn in, not just out. And they report. Where does the Secret Service report to? The Secretary of the Treasury.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's right. Right.
The president works for the banks, and the bankers have guys with guns on him every day making sure he does what the banks want.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Right. That's a great point. I mean, it gets back into the money issuance is tied into the monopolization of violence, monopolization of execution of the laws.
Right.
Right. They're tied together. And so what I'm saying here is that since the banks, you could just saw in that chart, the banks literally have more legal power now than the president does.
Right.
The president can be investigated. He could be subpoenaed and everything else. He's not above the law. The banks are above the law.
Right.
You know, nobody goes to jail. Nobody was even investigated. And that's a shocking thing, because what that means is there had to have been somewhere along the line, there had to have been a coup d'etat.
Right.
Because the constitutional government does not permit. We saw from the beginning, the whole premise of the country is nobody is above the law. And yet here we have people who are above the law.
So, I call it the financial coup. Sam Smith calls it the creeping coup. One of the aspects of compromising sovereignty was inserting private contractors to control the telecommunications and the information systems of the government and the payment system. So if you ever heard the story of the guys who went into Greece thinking that they were going to rebuild sovereignty, and they discovered that the bankers essentially controlled the payment systems that the taxes flowed in on, and they couldn't get control of the tax money, even though they were running the government.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I remember Greece was a big, that was 2013, if I recall.
Right. Yeah. And you've got the same problem in the U.S. government, because the president, is dealing with a group of corporate contractors running the payment systems and banks running the payment systems, and can't necessarily get control of the treasury flows.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
And so I want to go to TARP, because remember, the bailout, the TARP bailout passed right before the election, right?
Right, right.
Okay, that was October of 2008. The election's November 2008.
And Obama was very significant in making that happen as a senator.
Oh, we're going to see that big time.
Yeah.
We're going to see that big time. How important he's... I learn something when I do these. This is an eye-opener. But I want to set the stage for it by going to a film by Michael Moore in 2009 called Capitalism, A Love Story, in which he has a couple of interviews that are like, what did the person just say? And in this case, he's interviewing Elijah Cummings, representative from Maryland, and Marcy Kaptur, representative from Ohio. And he's talking about TARP. Like, how did they, because remember, TARP was rejected September 29th. The House voted it down. And then four days later, on October 3rd, the House passes it after it passed in the Senate. So what happened? And they're talking about, his interview with them is like, well, what went on there? How do you explain this? And their interview is very revealing, because it supports the theory there's been a coup d'etat. So I want to cut to these clips, because they're so good.
This whole fiasco shows you that there's some forces
that are not democratic.
Right, that are in control. Big time.
They did a masterful job. Very well executed.
Do you think it's too harsh to call what has happened here a coup d'etat, a financial coup d'etat?
That's no, because I think that's what's happened.
Yeah, how about that? Financial coup d'etat.
Yeah.
That's what they're saying with TARP.
Right.
Now, so what's Obama's connection to this? And again, this is something I learned doing this project. I tied things together. I knew about this document. I was like, I never saw the connection before. You have to go back over materials to sort of see the timeline and stuff. The timeline, that always tells you what's going on. But remember, I think it was 2016, WikiLeaks had a bunch of documents come out.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a memo that came out about Obama's cabinet before the election. You remember that? Let me show you this.
I don't remember this.
Yeah, okay. I wondered about that, but let's take a look at this. Okay, you're looking at a memo there. I'm going to zoom in. Don't worry here. This memo, let's just go through the particulars of it. This is from Michael Froman of Citigroup. Now, Citigroup was actually the biggest recipient of the bailouts of all. They got $45 billion of TARP along with Bank of America, but they really got from the Fed and the FDIC too. Citigroup was the biggest loser of the bunch, $28 billion in losses in 2008. So Froman from Citigroup is writing to John Podesta of the Obama transition team. Nice to know they're discussing this over Gmail. And notice the date here. I said October 3rd was when TARP passed. That was a Friday. Podesta's getting this from Froman on October 6th. So Monday, October 6th, 9:30 in the morning, Froman from Citigroup writes to Podesta saying, John, attached are three documents. The first two really don't concern us that much. They have to do with minority hires and diversity. And we want to talk about the third one. He says, at the risk of being presumptuous, I also scoped out how the cabinet-level appointments might be put together. So let's talk about Obama, what Citigroup, what we here at Citigroup think about the appointment process, who you might want to have. And so I want to go to the attachment there, the Word document that was attached there, and then zoom in, and we want to look at a couple. Most of this document, by the way, ended up becoming true. But I want to highlight Justice Department. They have Holder as a candidate. Ken Salazar didn't get it. And if you remember Holder, we saw UBS, right? But notice also that one of Covington and Burling's clients, Citigroup.
Right.
How about that? Isn't that funny? Anyway, keep it going. Let me just go to the next. Here we go. Back to the document that Froman is giving to John Podesta. The Treasury official, here you have three choices. You could have Robert Rubin.
Your favorite Geithner.
who is never, he's like chief of the executive office of Citigroup at the time. Or Tim, and actually he's not going to get it because he's implicated in a fraud within Citigroup involving mortgage-backed securities. Geithner or Larry Summers. Larry Summers is not going to get it either. The notion that Larry Summers, supposedly Geithner worked for Summers back in the day when Summers was Treasury Secretary. I'm here to tell you that the notion that Larry Summers was ever Geithner's boss is just absolutely, it's risible. That's just, okay, that's just, so anyway, that's an illustration of the power these banks have.
Right.
And that, in other words, that TARP was a really important thing. They needed that TARP to pass, that bailout to pass, before that cabinet came in, right?
Right.
Yeah. So in other words, Kaptur is right. That was coup d'etat.
Right.
Absolutely. That was a successful coup d'etat in the U.S. in broad daylight.
And what was amazing was, you know, the bailout vote was turned down the first time because there was more than 80% against. You know, I was calling my congressman's office every 5 minutes and she voted against. I mean, she voted against it both times. So, but literally it passed the second time around with more than 80% of the American people opposing it.
Yeah, right. And the initial opposition was more like 99-1.
Right.
I mean, when they first floated that around September 20th, people went ballistic.
Right.
It was crazy. Okay, but I want to turn back to something that you raised earlier about whether it's the same owners of the Fed and the banks and reconsider the issue of who has sovereign power, because it's not really it's not as straightforward. I want to do a comparison here. Back to who has sovereign power in the U.S., I want to compare the Fed and Wall Street banks, sort of like we compared Wall Street with Nixon. And we'll start with the Federal Reserve versus Wall Street. Who is the owner, okay, of the Fed and Wall Street? We don't know really who owns the Fed, and we don't really know who owns Wall Street banks.
Well, we know for the 12 member banks that their stocks are owned by their members.
Okay, and, but the members are...
The members are supposedly the banks in their jurisdiction.
Right.
But if you look at how their ownership works and how the ownership could trail back, I think you're right. It's a big question. The other thing is it's secret who they, as a practice, share their data with.
Right.
So
you know that.
Right.
But how do you know that?
So at the time I was doing research on who owned the Fed, I wrote to all the public affairs departments of the 12 banks. And I said, first of all, who owns you and who has what percent? It's not enough to say, you know, the members own us. I wanted to know which members have what percent. So that was number one. Number two, I said, who do you share your data? Who runs your data systems? What companies run your data systems? And who has access to that data? Do your members have access to the data? Who else has? And they wrote back and they said both are confidential. All 12.
Right.
I think some of them just never responded, but all the ones that did said that's confidential.
Or it's a trade secret or some such thing. You're but not getting, it. We're not telling.
Right. You. We're private. That's secret. No such luck.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Go pack sand. Yeah. So I want to get back to this comparison because it's telling about who is really in charge here. We don't know. So we don't know who the owner is. But who regulates these institutions? The Fed supposedly is regulated by Congress. Wall Street, in turn, the banks, they're regulated by the Fed. Okay? And that's so the Fed nominally is in charge of the banks, but that's not really the source of the Fed power.
Well, but OCC has jurisdiction as well.
Yes, that's true. But the right. But the Fed, you know, it's sort of like your parent, right? You know, you can't, you got to answer to both of them. And the Wall Street banks have to answer to the Fed, for sure.
They have to answer to the Fed, but then they own the Fed.
Right, right. But here's here's the key thing I want to get to.
Right.
Can it, I'm looking at both institutions as a single entity, can it be forced to take on liabilities? In the Fed's case, the answer is no. In Wall Street, the answer is yes. The Fed can force Wall Street banks, can force any bank under its jurisdiction to take on liabilities. That's the history. That's one of the things we've learned in the pandemic, that the Fed just, all it's got to do is buy an asset from a non-bank, and then the non-bank then has to go to its bank, and its bank sets up a deposit account, a liability, for the non-bank purchaser of the Fed's asset.
And we know that any Wall Street bank that refuses to take on liability for the Feds, like Bear Stearns,
yeah, exactly,
they find themselves shot.
Exactly, you're not long for this world. But legally, they have to do that. The Fed can say, you've got to accommodate this guy.
So let's go back. Show that chart again. I want to show you something.
Yeah.
This gets back. What this says is, okay, who is the owner? That's the important question.
Right.
That's
right.
The power equation. And we don't know. Right.
Okay, so keep this going. I'm getting to a point here. Can it be bankrupted? Fed cannot be bankrupted. I put an asterisk there. I'll explain that in a minute. Wall Street banks can be bankrupted.
Right.
For sure. Any bank can be bankrupted because they can't freely issue liabilities. And the reason for that is that, you know, you issue, let's say you're, you know, Joe Blow Bank, you set up a deposit account for $1 million on a loan. That depositor can turn around and say, hey, I want that in cash. And the bank can't freely print cash.
So think of it this way. This is so the real owners can make sure their employees behave.
Yeah.
Right.
You ding. I want to go back, though, to the asterisk on the Fed. At one time, in theory, the reason I have an asterisk there is it's now an unqualified no. But up until 1971, it was a qualified no because the Fed could issue liabilities. It did. It issued currency. And foreign countries like France could say, oh, yeah, $35 million is the same as a million ounces of gold. And it's redeemable. Let's say a million ounces of gold. And the Fed would have to produce it. So in that sense, the Fed at one time, it really couldn't be bankrupted, but it could be, it was issuing real liabilities. Now it doesn't issue real liabilities. Now it's basically issuing money. But let's go to the next question. Can it issue legal tender? The Fed can, and the banks can't, right? The Fed, in other words, the Fed has the power to extinguish debts, and Wall Street banks do not. And that's really just that as far as the power. In other words, the power of the U.S. is with the Fed.
Can I mention one more thing?
Yeah.
If you look at that chart, the New York Fed runs the Exchange Stabilization Fund,
right?
Which is what I call the financial bazooka, which is one of the most important roles of a reserve currency. You've got to have basically a financial nuclear arsenal is the only way I can describe it. And it's dependent on all these different banks to implement, you know, many of those operations. But that is, you know, that is arguably one of, if not the most powerful points in the whole financial system, and they control that.
Right. The other thing they control, and this is really, we'll wind down and conclude the presentation. The reason I bring this up, the legal relationship between the Fed and between the banks, is that the banks are not, the Wall Street banks, private banks, are not in a position to destroy U.S. sovereignty But the Fed is. The Fed most certainly is, because it has the power of legal tender.
Well, the Fed has.
The Fed has that right. power. Yes.
And you know who their biggest helpmate has been doing that?
Their biggest
helpmate.
No.
Congress.
Yeah. Big
Congress.
Problem.
Congress has legalized usury. Congress has destroyed the next generation with student debt. Congress has allowed the government to operate without obeying the Constitution and the financial management laws, and on and on and right. on. Congress, you know, when Eisenhower first prepared his military-industrial speech, he was going to have it be military-industrial congressional complex, and at the last minute, cut out the Congress.
Right. So let's talk about usury for a second. Congress has enabled the Fed with usury. The way that works is when the U.S. needs money, okay, it has to issue an IOU. Under the Federal Reserve System, the U.S. government issues an IOU at interest, and the Fed issues the money at no right. interest.
Right.
So there's an arbitrage between the bond rate and the zero rate on the currency that's going into the Fed's pocket. That's pure usury, because there's no risk to the Fed. The Fed's entire power derives from the government. So yeah, I'm not saying the government will never fail. It certainly is. But what I am saying is, from the Fed's point of view, that's no difference at all, because if the government goes down, it's taking the Fed with it. That is pure usury.
So the Fed would argue that the dividends after expenses flow back to the Treasury?
Right.
Now,
that's
if you trust their numbers.
That's if you trust their numbers. And that's ignoring the fact, as I pointed out earlier, the Fed isn't issuing liabilities. It's got
right.
It's got $8 trillion now, $8.5 trillion of liabilities sitting on its balance sheet. They're not liabilities, are they?
No.
They're equity. Whose
right.
equity are they?
Right.
That equity belongs to us.
Right.
And they've enriched themselves to the tune of $8.5, $9 trillion. That's our money. That's
right.
not a liability. It can't be redeemed in anything other than what the Fed itself creates. Right?
Right. Right.
Okay. So that's a bunch of nonsense. Oh, well, we give it all back to the Treasury. Yeah. Okay. you're giving peanuts back to the Treasury. In the meantime, you're ignoring the $9 trillion you stole. It's sitting right there in a balance sheet, and you're hiding
right.
it in broad daylight by calling it a liability. It's not.
It's not.
But then the point to bring up about the sovereignty is, you know, these CBDCs are a real risk, because eventually, you know, all these countries are going for CBDCs at the same time. And you've heard Jerome Powell say any number of times, along with any number of other central bankers, that the CBDC is going to be the third liability on the Fed's balance sheet after reserves and after cash. So they're calling it a liability. Now, and all the nations are doing it. And so you could see a scenario where all the nations need to settle their transactions in the same way that commercial banks need to settle their IOUs, right? They're trading among each other. We need to settle things out. Eventually, there will be a time when along comes someone and says, you know, we need a way to settle these transactions. And that's how it'll be pitched. We need a currency. You know, the world's changed. You know, things are different now. We need a world reserve currency to settle these transactions. It can't be the dollar, because the dollar, you know, the CBDC is a liability. The Fed says so. The BIS says so. We need a reserve currency just to settle among currencies. And once that happens, once there's a reserve, in other words, once there's a currency that the Fed can't print and that the government can't print, that's ball game.
Right.
Then they got you. They got you the same way the Fed has Wall Street banks. Right.
Well, that's why the logical thing is they do want to use humans as the collateral, because
yeah.
then they can force a totally accountable system, which will be absolutely gruesome and brutal for the people.
Right. You got it.
Right.
Right now, you know, when the collateral on the Fed's the collateral on the Fed's liabilities, the corresponding asset is bonds. Right. It's U.S.,
right.
but it's IOUs from the government. But there's no reason that they can't atomize that down to the individual level and use people.
Right.
You know, to individual notes on people to collateralize.
So the
CBDC.
Pain, I would say the pain of the current system is inflation or debasement.
Right.
The pain of the CBDC system is slavery.
Yes. It's outright ownership.
Right.
And one of the things I point out in the paper and the written materials is human beings have been used as money in history.
Right.
It's been a while. And not, more recently in Central Africa, but 1500s in Spain, when Spain conquered South America and part of the Americas, people were used as money. It gets back to we're reversing history, as we saw at the outset.
So there are two things I wanted to bring up before we close. One is when I was litigating with the Department of Justice, and I really had to explore the issues, some of the issues that you so beautifully described today, I realized that the bankers were spending phenomenal time and money on the appearance of the rule of law. In other words, part of it was they had access to taxpayers' money to do it. But at one point during the litigation, when I realized how much money they were spent on my surveillance, on, 18 audits and investigations, 12 tracks of litigation, 24/7 surveillance, I thought, this is unbelievably expensive. Why don't they just kill me? I mean, clearly they just kill people all the time. What's the problem? And I realized, they need it to look like I've lost. They needed me to look like I've failed. It has become, I believe, the biggest job program in the world, is sort of managing things so they can continually pretend that the rule of law exists. And what I realized was the whole system, the multiple between 20 and 1 in the stock market comes from persuading people and them having confidence in the appearance of the rule of law. And it's a huge industry.
It's got to be. What I would call the theater management.
Yeah.
It's untold millions of people employed in that industry.
It's incredible.
Yeah, it is.
And part of it is, as we've stolen the money out of the federal government and blown all these bubbles with quantitative easing, and all the different things the Fed is doing with going direct, they're blowing bubble after bubble after bubble. And to keep all these assets spiraling around, it's like that movie Margin Call. They need all these pretend stories of why these things have real value and why these prices are justified. And, that was one of Bernanke's really great qualities. He could, both he and Greenspan could invent stories of why things were worth this much and say it with a straight face. Bernanke could just say it with a straight face. You just couldn't believe it.
Yeah, but his body language would give him away, as you just saw.
Yeah, that's the first time I've seen his body language really give him away. Okay, so one of the things I wanted to think about was that the appearance of the rule of law, is very significant. The other thing is the population for a long time, the general population, particularly in America and the G7, has bought in. Because I think everybody realizes the day the party stops, they're in trouble.
Right.
And so there's been a real fear of pulling the plug on the party. And when I've explored with people why they're afraid to pull the plug, what I realize is that so many brilliant, educated, intelligent people do not understand what it has meant to enjoy the blessings of sovereignty, of individual sovereignty, and of, the Treaty of Westphalia, national sovereignty. They have no, we are so spoiled because we've always enjoyed it. We don't understand what it's like to live in a world where it doesn't exist.
And the rule of law, going back to 1215.
Right.
The Magna Carta. I mean, these are ancient concepts. I want to touch on something, though, you said with, why there's such a huge investment in the appearance of the rule of law.
Right.
And there's a video, and I talk about it in the paper. There's a video, a presentation by Glenn Greenwald at Yale Law School in 2013, where he talks about the rule of law. He had written a book called In Liberty and Justice for Some. And he talks about the rule of law. And a very important point he makes during that presentation is the role that fear plays in the rule of law. That the rulers, in a healthy functioning society, the rulers over the rule, they have fear. That they know the rule of law is important. They know that a level playing field is important. And so they go out of their way because they might be feared of, they might be afraid of, you know, physical violence. They might be afraid of reputational damage, whatever it is.
Right.
They're afraid that of being perceived as somebody abusive or somebody tyrannical. And he says, and now you have the society where that fear has been inverted. And now in an unhealthy society, you have the populace that's afraid of the government, not the other way around. But the rule of law is very much an institution that depends on fear. And it's up to us, I think, to exercise, you know, our right of free speech and free assembly to hold these people's feet to the fire and use the fear to our advantage, because that's a big part of the rule of law, whether you like it or not.
Right. Bob Moran has this new, I think I sent it to you, this new cartoon where this media machine is pouring out fear, 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 and the people are reaching up and grabbing a life, a life, it's on the ship, life, you know, it's...
Lifeboat.
Lifeboat. But, and it says on it, slavery.
okay.
Right.
Life preserver.
They're reaching up and grabbing the life preserver. Okay, two other points. I just finished doing a long discussion about Bitcoin on Mercola's show. And one of the things that came out was the young man I was talking with, you know, and a great enthusiast about Bitcoin, was basically saying, look, most people are untrustworthy. Bitcoin creates a covenant. We can go off as a group and have a covenant. We don't need to worry about these other people. They're not going to, you know, they really can't make it in this environment. And he didn't understand that if the majority of the population is expendable, then he and the Bitcoin enthusiasts will not be free. In other words, we talked about this last week on Money and Market. It's kind of a 0-1 thing. It's everybody or nothing.
Right.
It's not going to work. And he couldn't understand that.
Yeah. Well, in other words, if you have a situation and the level playing field is gone and some people are above the law, you're at their mercy, whether you like it or not.
Right.
Yeah. You might try to convince yourself that that's not the case. That's the case.
Right.
If certain group of people, whether it's bankers, whoever, is literally above the law, it's written into the Justice Department, U.S. Attorney's Manual, that banks, you know, their collateral consequences have to be considered. So they have special dispensation. They're above the law. It is open season on you whenever they want.
Right. Well, it was funny because my big issue in the 90s, you know, they were doing it in poor neighborhoods. And my big issue is if you look at a negative return on economy, if you let this go down, at some point they got to go after the middle class. They have to go after everybody. It's not, right. You know, it's a matter of time. Okay, so there's last one thing I do want to say before we close. First of all, this has been absolutely fantastic. So I didn't get to see it before we recorded. I got a hint of the outline, but I didn't get to see it. And this is, you know, John, you never cease to just, you know, produce that wow in terms of defining and framing the issues. I'm big on frameworks, but I just have to say, you're somebody, when I first saw the first thing you did and became aware of your work during the financial crisis, I was like, wow, who is this guy? You know, and this is the ultimate lyric compliment. He really gets it.
Well, thank you. I think it boils to me. What I like about this is everything comes down, everything's simple. It's storytelling.
Right.
Yeah, this stuff doesn't happen at random or out of the blue.
Right. Sovereignty is the whole framework upon which we stand. And it's
the ball of wax.
Yep. And that's why, you know, people keep saying, what should I do with my money? And I keep saying, if there's no rule of law, it doesn't matter.
All bets are off.
Right. So you got to take some of your money and put it towards making sure there's a rule of law. But, you know, it's really funny. All my friends from Eastern Europe, they get it like that because they live through, you know, they live through all these horrible times in a world where sovereignty was being destroyed or taken. So they know. Anyway, but you absolutely have done a fantastic job, and I can't thank you enough. And I can't wait to get this one out in hard copy.
Well, Hopefully, thank you. As I said to you, this could be turned into a book.
Yep.
I'll do what I can, you know, but this has been a challenge to get it in 90 minutes. But I'm really glad I had this opportunity because it forced me to look at these issues again, like, wow, and see things that I hadn't seen. And looking at them after 10 years, I'm seeing new things.
Well,
so it was a great experience.
I don't want you to feel obligated, but if you'll write the book, we'll publish it.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be great.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Salieri Report.